Welcome to Bedside Manners, the North Carolina Medical Society podcast, where we discuss issues related to the physician-patient relationship. I'm your host, Elaine Ellis. In this episode of Bedside Manners, I speak with Judith Sands, an RN with over 30 years of experience in case management and patient safety. Judith recently published a guidebook as a resource for caregivers navigating the home hospice system. In the book, she offers her expertise as a healthcare professional alongside her personal insights gained in caring for her mother. While the guide is aimed at caregivers, in this podcast, Judith shares what physicians and PAs can contribute to patient safety, care coordination, and dignity at the end of life. Welcome, Judith Sands. So, Judith, as a healthcare professional and as someone who cared for elderly parents at the end of their lives, what really is the context for this book?
We can't take the dying out of the healthcare experience. Death has been sanitized. Most individuals today have not seen someone die. 100 years ago, people died at home with their family and loved ones around them. Now, how we live, where we live, our separation from our nuclear family, we don't have those extended, we don't have an extended family around us. So people are dying in nursing homes, in hospitals, in hospices, alone. Mm-hmm. And that is sad because that is the one time when someone really needs to be supported and loved, but also the caregivers and the family members need to be there. When my husband's grandmother was dying, my kids were 3 and 5. And we took them to the nursing home. They climbed in the bed. One brushed her hair and the other put hand lotion on it. We felt that they needed to see older people and they needed to see that someone was declining.
Mm-hmm. So what ultimately prompted you to undertake this book?
Home hospice navigation really came out of a journey as a result of navigating my mother's home hospice journey and caregiving, as well as being a resource to others undergoing challenges with the care management process. My mom would often say to me, "Why are you fighting for me? Why don't we just accept the way things are?" And it became important to say some of the recommendations for your treatment plan are really not the best. There's a potential for increasing your fall risk. There are other modalities or medications that have less side effects that can keep you more engaged and so you can continue to participate in some of those activities that you really enjoy. And she would say, "Well, then what do people do who don't have someone with your knowledge and experience to navigate the process?" And that really became the light bulb that fueled the book. Mom was very involved in the early versions of the book, sharing information, and her wish that end-of-life care truly reflect living and that individuals had the opportunity to participate as much as possible in activities of daily living.
So were you learning along with your mom during her journey with an eye toward writing this book or helping other people? And so you were collecting stories and your own experiences as you were living them with the idea that perhaps they would be helpful to other people?
Yes, that truly was some of the content that fueled the book. As unusual situations surfaced, frustrations, things that didn't quite match how a traditional plan of care is executed. These were the little notes kept in a diary that were pulled out as the book was written.
That's great. And you really do get a sense in the book that it's very personal, and you speak with great authority, both as a healthcare professional and as someone who's lived it. That's very helpful.
It is different being a clinician, a nurse, someone providing the care routinely as part of your job, and then turning your hat around and saying, now I'm caring for a loved one, whether that be a parent, a spouse, a sibling, a child. The roles change. Sometimes we as caregivers or professionals in the caregiving business need to kind of stop and step back a minute and remember we are serving in a caregiving role. We need to turn off our professional responsibilities now and then.
Medical society here, you know, our members are physicians and PAs. I'm wondering if we could just talk a little bit about the physician's role, how you see that, and how they may be of particular help to the caregiver as well as the patient.
The physician, the PA, plays a huge role in the end-of-life care. And I believe it starts with that whole advanced directive process. Talking to the patient and the family about how they want to live the last part of their life. And I don't refer to it as dying because there is still some living that goes on. It is having that honest communication and really peeling back the onion and specific. Do you want to be placed on a ventilator? Do you want a feeding tube, and going through that litany of life-prolonging interventions and really explaining to the patient and family, what does that mean? How will that change their ability to participate in activities of daily living? We know that 75% of Americans would like to die at home, yet unfortunately, only 25% get that opportunity. So it's the identification of those wishes, communicating them to the medical team, completing all the required paperwork, and often it's the physician, the provider, saying, you know what, I think or I believe you would benefit from a post or a most form. That appears to be in keeping with your wishes, and explaining to the patient and family where those copies need to be maintained, whether it's on the fridge, next to the bedside, so that if for some reason someone calls EMS, then those folks have the guidance to provide comfort care and not initiate life-prolonging procedures. The medical professionals are ones that are going to really help provide that reality check balanced with good clinical judgment to how to keep that individual comfortable.
When do you think this, ideally, this conversation should take place?
Talking about end-of-life wishes should begin in a non-crisis situation. Hopefully, over time, practitioners have a rapport with their patients, especially those who are a little more fragile. And then it becomes part of whether it's an annual Medicare wellness visit to ask those questions. It may become part of a discussion if a patient shares that a family member or a friend is on the decline. That's a great opener to say, well, what are your thoughts? How would you like to be cared for should you not be able to articulate your own wishes? Determine if their individual has had some kind of a discussion with a spouse, a significant other, but also with the children. If they have completed advanced directives, have they been uploaded to the registries? I think, and one of the most important things is to remind patients not to put them in their safe deposit box, because then they're not available in a crisis situation.
I know you mentioned the annual wellness visit as an ideal time to have these types of conversations. And I know you mentioned in your book that it's been fairly recently that Medicare will cover the end-of-life conversations as part of that annual wellness visit. Do you have any sense of how aware physicians are about that? And if you feel that the whole end-of-life conversation is becoming more and more part of the general care of patients.
I'd like to hope that those practitioners that are providing care to Medicare beneficiaries are well aware that as of January 1st, 2016, that advanced care planning is part of that annual wellness visit. It is challenging to have those conversations. It is time consuming. And the reality is, depending on how many patients someone has to see within a given time frame, that important conversation may not get the focus it needs. But yet, it could be a time at least to begin a conversation, share resources, and determine if the individual has even thought about it. Some practitioners may have some handouts and say, you know what, here's some information, and we'll talk about it again, or please let's bring this up in another visit. Although at that point, it's not part of the whole billable process. Mm-hmm. But it is such a critical piece, and it gives the practitioner some idea as to how that particular individual views care and management when they're unable to speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Beyond just the time-consuming nature of these conversations and how physicians are reimbursed for them, do you think there's any reluctance on the part of physicians to avoid having this kind of conversation because they're very focused on healing and prolonging life, and that maybe sometimes they might lose track of the importance of that journey?
Yes. Professionally, over my career, I have encountered situations where, unfortunately, the practitioner could really not share with the family that the prognosis was not rosy, that everything that one had in the toolkit had been used, and sometimes practitioners view it as a personal failure, and that's unfortunate. If that particular practitioner does not feel comfortable having the conversation, then who should? Is there a specialist on the case who may be more appropriate? That needs to be evaluated. But it's really about the patient. We are obligated to at least identify where the patient stands, what are their wishes, see how we can best honor them.
What do you think would be one takeaway that they should take away as a healthcare professional?
I'd hope that they would take away that the role of the caregiver is truly a 24/7 job. As someone progresses and declines, the obligations of the caregiver increase. And the provider may be the first one to really look at, is the caregiver willing, able, and available to meet the caregiving demands? The individual may be a 100-pound woman, but her husband is 250 pounds and maybe 6 foot tall. Early in management, caregiving, that person can perform those tasks. But the ability down the road as they may no longer be mobile or able to participate. So although that individual is willing, they're no longer able. Mm-hmm. Again, you may have someone willing up front, but as it care involves more hands-on, the toileting, the bathing, they may not feel comfortable providing that. Mm-hmm. And they may no longer be available, or they may be available up front, but there are other things that take them away from caring for the patient. They may have grandchildren. They may have a job. They themselves may have a decline in their health status. So willing, able, and available, reality check to see how well the caregiver is doing and are they surviving.
That is really the focus of your book, is the caregiver's guide. The caregiver also needs care and attention.
Another thing would be for providers, when the patient is already on a hospice journey, maybe to suggest a respite stay or push the caregiver to consider what other additional resources they can tap into to help them. And unfortunately, finances often become the constraint or the barrier. The cost of care and tapping into professional caregivers, whether they be home health aides or nurses, that adds up, because not only is there an hourly charge for that service, there is typically also a minimum hours that need to be booked. Physicians and practitioners are often focused on the here and now, what happens in my office during the visit. The amount of time the provider has to spend with the patient and family is limited. And too often, we all know, even under the best of circumstances, we walk out of the provider's office and go, oh, shoot, I should have asked X, Y, or Z. I don't think I fully understood what was said. The intent of the book is to provide just-in-time information to survive the caregiving journey and be aware of some of the pitfalls that can be associated with aspects of care.
Great. Well, is there anything else you'd like to touch on?
I think one issue that's also important for providers to share relates to home safety. Stressing to the family members that the loved one's status is changing, that they may have been able to do things before, but their ability to participate in activities of daily living is on the decline. And what do they need to do to keep the home safe? Two big things are fall prevention, and the other would be medication safety. Especially if someone is on hospice, it is management of the hospice medication or comfort pack. Often that contains narcotics. Reminding family that they really need to watch where that's stored, who has access to it, because unfortunately we're living in a time when things are being diverted or inappropriately used.
So Judith, what has been the response to your book? I know I've seen signs for several presentations you've done, and has it been well received?
The book has been very well received. In fact, I have several physicians with whom I have a relationship who will send me a note. I need you to send books out to my colleagues, or here are some of the patients, which has been heartwarming because these are respected practitioners who then say, I know someone who will value what you're sharing.
Yeah, well, thank you for doing this, and thank you for writing the book.
And thank you for your assistance in helping to support caregivers by sharing this information.
If you'd like to learn more about Judith and Judith's book, Home Hospice Navigation, The Caregiver's Guide, it's available on Amazon, or visit her website, judithsands.com, where there are valuable resources and links to the forms mentioned in this podcast. You can also find end-of-life resources on the North Carolina Medical Society website at ncmedsoc.org. Thank you for listening.